Chapter 23 was what I'd never known before, and it's better than anything I've known. She spoke in a low, even voice, without tears or visible agitation, and each word, as it dropped from her, fell into his breast like burning lead. He sat bowed over, his head between his hands, staring at the earthrig, and at the tip of the satin shoe that showed under her dress. Suddenly he knelt down, and kissed the shoe. She bent over him, laying her hands on his shoulders, and looking at him with eyes so deep that he remained motionless under her gaze. "Ah, don't let us undo what you've done," she cried. "I can't go back now to that other way of thinking. I can't love you unless I give you up." His arms were yearning up to her, but she drew away, and they remained facing each other, divided by the distance that her words had created. Then, abruptly, his anger overflowed. "And Beaufort? Is he to replace me?" As the words sprang out, he was prepared for an answering flare of anger, and he would have welcomed it as fuel for his own. But Madame Olenska only grew a shade paler, and stood with her arms hanging down before her, and her head slightly bent, as her way was when she pondered a question. "He's waiting for you now at Mrs. Truther's. Why don't you go to him?" Archer sneered. She turned to ring the bell. "She'll not go out this evening. Tell the carriage to go and fetch the Signora Marchesa," she said when the maid came. After the door had closed again, Archer continued to look at her with bitter eyes. "Why this sacrifice? Since you tell me that you're lonely, I've no right to keep you from your friends." She smiled a little under her wet lashes. "Shan't be lonely now. I was lonely, I was afraid. But the emptiness and the darkness are gone. When I turn back into myself now, I'm like a child going at night into a room where there's always a light." Her tone and her look still enveloped her in a soft inaccessibility, and Archer groaned out again. "Don't understand you. Yet you understand me." He reddened under the retort, but kept his eyes on her. "A is ready to give me up." "What? 3 days after you've entreated her on your knees to hasten your marriage?" "She's refused. That gives me the right." "Ah, you've taught me what an ugly word that is," she said. He turned away with a sense of utter weariness. He felt as though he had been struggling for hours up the face of a steep precipice, and now, just as he had fought his way to the top, his hold had given way, and he was pitching down headlong into darkness. If he could have got her in his arms again, he might have swept away her arguments, but she still held him at a distance by something inscrutably aloof in her look and attitude, and by his own odd sense of her sincerity. At length he began to plead again. "If we do this now, it will be worse afterward, worse for everyone." "No, no, no," she almost screamed, as if he frightened her. At that moment the bell sent a long tinkle through the house. They had heard no carriage stopping at the door, and they stood motionless, looking at each other with startled eyes. Outside, Nastasia's step crossed the hall, the outer door opened, and a moment later she came in carrying a telegram which she handed to the Countess Olenska. The lady was very happy at the flowers, Nastasia said, smoothing her apron. He thought it was her Signor Marito who had sent them, and she cried a little, and said it was a folly. Her mistress smiled, and took the yellow envelope. She tore it open, and carried it to the lamp. Then, when the door had closed again, she handed the telegram to Archer. It was dated from St. Augustine, and addressed to the Countess Olenska. In it he read, "Granny's telegram successful. Papa and Mama agree marriage after Easter. I'm telegraphing Newland. I'm too happy for words, and love you dearly. Your grateful May." Half an hour later, when Archer unlocked his own front door, he found a similar envelope on the hall table on top of his pile of notes and letters. The message inside the envelope was also from May Welland, and ran as follows. "Arrange consent wedding Tuesday after Easter at 12 Grace Church, 8 bridesmaids, please see rector, so happy love May." Archer crumpled up the yellow sheet, as if the gesture could annihilate the news it contained. Then he pulled out a small pocket diary and turned over the pages with trembling fingers. But he did not find what he wanted, and cramming the telegram into his pocket he mounted the stairs. A light was shining through the door of the little hall room which served Janie as a dressing room and boudoir, and her brother rapped impatiently on the panel. The door opened, and his sister stood before him in her immemorial purple flannel dressing gown, with her hair and pins. Her face looked pale and apprehensive. Newland, I hope there's no bad news in that telegram. I waited on purpose, in case no item of his correspondence was safe from Janie. He took no notice of her question. Look here, what day is Easter this year? She looked shocked at such unchristian ignorance. Easter? Newland. Why, of course, the first week in April. Why? The first week? He turned again to the pages of his diary, calculating rapidly under his breath. The first week, did you say? He threw back his head with a long laugh. For mercy's sake, what's the matter? Nothing's the matter, except that I'm going to be married in a month. Janie fell upon his neck and pressed him to her purple flannel breast. H. Newland, how wonderful. I'm so glad. But, dearest, why do you keep on laughing? Do hush, or you'll wake Mama. Book 2, 6. The day was fresh, with a lively spring wind full of dust. All the old ladies in both families had got out their faded sables and yellow ermines, and the smell of camphor from the front pews almost smothered the faint spring scent of the lilies banking the altar. Newland Archer, at a signal from the sexton, had come out of the vestry and placed himself with his best man on the chancel step of Grace Church. The signal meant that the brougham bearing the bride and her father was in sight, but there was sure to be a considerable interval of adjustment and consultation in the lobby, where the bridesmaids were already hovering like a cluster of Easter blossoms. During this unavoidable lapse of time, the bridegroom, in proof of his eagerness, was expected to expose himself alone to the gaze of the assembled company. And Archer had gone through this formality as resignedly as through all the others which made of a 19th century New York wedding a rite that seemed to belong to the dawn of history. Everything was equally easy or equally painful, as one chose to put it, in the path he was committed to tread, and he had obeyed the flurried injunctions of his best man as piously as other bridegrooms had obeyed his own, in the days when he had guided them through the same labyrinth. So far he was reasonably sure of having fulfilled all his obligations. The bridesmaids' 8 bouquets of white lilac and lilies of the valley had been sent in due time, as well as the gold and sapphire sleeve links of the 8 ushers, and the best man's cat's eye scarf pin. Archer had sat up half the night trying to vary the wording of his thanks for the last batch of presents from men friends and ex-lady loves. The fees for the bishop and the rector were safely in the pocket of his best man. His own luggage was already at Mrs. Manson Mingott's, where the wedding breakfast was to take place, and so were the traveling clothes into which he was to change, and a private compartment had been engaged in the train that was to carry the young couple to their unknown destination, concealment of the spot in which the bridal night was to be spent being one of the most sacred taboos of the prehistoric ritual. Got the ring all right? Whispered young Van der Leyden Newland, who was inexperienced in the duties of a best man, and awed by the weight of his responsibility. Archer made the gesture which he had seen so many bridegrooms make. With his ungloved right hand he felt in the pocket of his dark gray waistcoat, and assured himself that the little gold circlet engraved inside, Newland to May, April-187, was in its place. Then, resuming his former attitude, his tall hat and pearl-gray gloves with black stitchings grasped in his left hand, he stood looking at the door of the church. Overhead, Handel's march swelled pompously through the imitation stone vaulting, carrying on its waves the faded drift of the many weddings at which, with cheerful indifference, he had stood on the same chancel step watching other brides float up the nave toward other bridegrooms. how like a first night at the opera, he thought, recognizing all the same faces in the same boxes, no, pews, and wondering if, when the last trump sounded, Mrs. Selfridge Mary would be there with the same towering ostrich feathers in her bonnet, and Mrs. Beaufort with the same diamond earrings and the same smile, and whether suitable proscenium seats were already prepared for them in another world. After that there was still time to review, one by one, the familiar countenances in the first rows, the women sharp with curiosity and excitement, the men sulky with the obligation of having to put on their frock coats before luncheon, and fight for food at the wedding breakfast. Too bad the breakfast is at old Catherine's, the bridegroom could fancy Reggie Chivers saying, but I'm told that Lovell Mingott insisted on its being cooked by his own chef, so it ought to be good, if one can only get at it. And he could imagine Sillerton Jackson adding with authority, why, dear fellow, haven't you heard? It's to be served at small tables, in the new English fashion. Archer's eyes lingered a moment on the left-hand pew, where his mother, who had entered the church on Mr. Henry van der Luyden's arm, sat weeping softly under her chantilly veil, her hands in her grandmother's ermine muff. Poor Janie, he thought, looking at his sister, even by screwing her head around she can see only the people in the few front pews, and they're mostly dowdy Newlands and Dagonets. On the hither side of the white ribbon dividing off the seats reserved for the families he saw Beaufort, tall and red-faced, scrutinizing the women with his arrogant stare. Beside him sat his wife, all silvery chinchilla and violets, and on the far side of the ribbon, Lawrence Lefferts' sleekly brushed head seemed to mount guard over the invisible deity of Ute Form who presided at the ceremony. Archer wondered how many flaws Lefferts' keen eyes would discover in the ritual of his divinity. Then he suddenly recalled that he too had once thought such questions important. The things that had filled his day seemed now like a nursery parody of life, or like the wrangles of medieval schoolmen over metaphysical terms that nobody had ever understood. A stormy discussion as to whether the wedding presents should be counted had darkened the last hours before the wedding, and it seemed inconceivable to Archer that grown-up people should work themselves into a state of agitation over such trifles, and that the matter should have been decided in the negative by Mrs. Willand saying, with indignant tears, should as soon turn the reporters loose in my house. Yet there was a time when Archer had had definite and rather aggressive opinions on all such problems, and when everything concerning the manners and customs of his little tribe had seemed to him fraught with worldwide significance. And all the while, I suppose, he thought, real Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.